Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 2, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Today, we welcome back to our program best-selling author Andy McCarthy. His latest book is Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. He's the executive director of the Philadelphia Freedom Center, as well as the contributing editor at National Review and a senior fellow at the National Review Institute. His larger bio has been provided to you in the notice of this call. It's also available on our website. He's going to give us some opening remarks of some 10 to 15 minutes or so, and then we'll get to your questions. So without further, Mr. McCarthy, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thank you once again to the Federalist Society for inviting me and for everyone who's attending. I also have to extend some thanks to Fox News, which because of a little bit of a scheduling hiccup, I ended up here today instead of where I intended to be, but they were good enough to actually lower the volume of Fox News here at Fox News so that we could go forward, which is something I'm sure that's fairly unusual here. So. Thank you very much to them also for providing a place where we could do this. The marathon bombing, which happened on April 15th, has provoked a number of controversies in the ensuing couple of weeks. I think in an overarching way, what I would want to hearken back to is the period around 2004, 2005, when I and a number of other commentators started to suggest that we ought to be thinking about a third way for dealing with counterterrorism issues, and in particular the legal issues that stem from what's been called the war on terror. And the reason for the conclusion that a third system is necessary. I called it a national security court. There have been other proposals of a similar type. But the reason is that there are two paradigms that we have dealt with over the years. We have treated terrorism, and when throughout the 90s we did it this way, as a national, as a criminal justice issue, so that primarily terrorism was something that was handled in the U.S. courts, and in fact, almost all of the cases, I think all but one that was out in Seattle involving the Millennium bombing case, but almost all of the cases, beginning with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and concluding with the 1998 embassy bombings, where a trial was held in late 2000 into 2001, almost all of those cases were handled in the office where I was privileged to work during those years, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. And the law enforcement paradigm essentially meant that unless you were lucky enough to have an informant into an active terror plot, and that really only happened once to speak of, you were basically in a posture where you were waiting to be hit by terrorists and contenting yourself with post-facto investigation and prosecution, assuming that you could obtain the presence of at least some of the terrorists in court and proceed against them. Post 9/11, I think the horrific nature and dimension of the 9/11 attacks convinced people that the law enforcement paradigm was unacceptable from a national security perspective. It wasn't a question of whether you could get terrorists convicted in court. That was clearly true. So it worked in that sense, in the due process sense. But it didn't work as a national security strategy. So post 9/11, we moved to more of a prevention / intelligence strategy, which very much subordinated the due process rights of the a suspected terrorist, and emphasized the ability to gather intelligence proactively and actually try to interrupt cells and plots before attacks could take place. That was a very successful strategy in terms of preventing attacks from happening, But it did provoke a fierce debate, which really hasn't ended since then, about where we ought to be drawing due process lines and what standards ought to apply in terms of whether somebody is deemed to be a criminal defendant against whom you should proceed in the civilian courts, or an enemy combatant who can be detained without trial in the civilian courts, and if you have provable war crimes, can be tried by military commission. I think taking a step back, and this is the thinking that goes into the third way, neither of these paradigms really is a good fit for the terrorist threat that we've been facing for the past 20 years, and that, that really visited itself in a powerful way against the United States in the 9/11 attacks. This wave of terrorism that we've been dealing with for 20 years is clearly not a crime wave, but neither is it a traditional war. And a lot of the detention issues that we have dealt with in past wars were fairly easy to deal with because we were dealing with traditional enemies and uniformed combatants. So that, for example, even the case against the German saboteurs, the Kieran case in 1942, involved Nazi saboteurs, and there was no real issue about whether they were German operatives or not. Modern terrorism, of course, is very different. You're dealing with people who systematically violate the laws and customs of war, not least by directly attacking civilian populations, but also importantly by dressing the part of civilians rather than as honorable combatants do, wearing uniforms, carrying their weapons openly, belonging to a regular chain of command, and the like. As a logical matter, that really ought to mean they're entitled to less rights because they are, in many ways, their conduct is more heinous. But from a political standpoint, what it ends up meaning is that you're always going to have some ambiguity with respect to terrorists unless you catch them exactly in the act of committing a terrorist act. You're always going to have ambiguity about whether they're terrorists or just ordinary civilians. And because of that ambiguity, there's always going to be difficult issues raised in their detention. So my suggestion of a national security court was to try to, rather than take the very new and different challenge that we've been dealing with, and try to force it into these two systems, neither of which were really designed for modern terrorism, that is the civilian justice system or the military system, try to develop something that was tailored more for the realities of modern international terrorism. And while a number of commentators thought that that might be a good idea and certainly was something that was worth exploring, it's something that unfortunately we haven't had any interest in Washington in pursuing. And the you know, the problem with that is that you are always going to have cases that, that come up. It was almost inevitable that this would happen, where you had circumstances that really brought to the fore in stark relief exactly the problem I'm referring to, which is the inadequacy of the two existing paradigms to really deal with terrorism in an effective way. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in the Boston Marathon attack. We have a situation where at least two people are involved in the plot. The bombing, of course, killed three people and injured and maimed numerous others. Their connection, if any, to any organized international terrorist organization or network is something that's that at the moment is ambiguous at best. And you know, a lot of people are starting to draw the conclusion. I think it's too early to draw this conclusion that there's no connection to any either Al-Qaeda franchise or one of its affiliates. this is a matter of great importance because in order to qualify as an enemy combatant, the issue is not whether you commit terrorism. Terrorism can be committed by activists or operatives of any ideological stripe and any allegiance. What makes someone an enemy combatant rather than simply a terrorist is whether you are a part of the enemy that Congress has authorized the use of military force against. And part of the problem that a number of us have been agitating about for a number of years now is that we're really still operating under the authorization of military force that Congress enacted about a week after the 9/11 attacks. And that AUMF is really limited to people, organizations, and nations that carried out the 9/11 attacks or that harbored those who did carry out the 9/11 attacks. It has never been overhauled, tweaked, tinkered with, or fine-tuned in any way over the last 12 years to bring it into the current reality of the war. And to be a little bit more concrete about what that all means, I noted, I guess this is 2010, 2011, I don't remember exactly when this happened, but you'll recall that a guy named Shahzad tried to set a bomb off in Times Square. When the investigation of that was finally done and over with, it emerged that Shahzad had been trained by and probably dispatched here by the Pakistani Taliban. That was interesting because the Pakistani Taliban did not even exist at the time of the 9/11 attacks. It came into being actually a couple of years after that. And its connection to the 9/11 attacks was strained at and attenuated at best, meaning there was a real question whether he actually would have qualified as an enemy combatant, whether he would have qualified as being in the category of the enemy that Congress had authorized military force against. And what I thought was interesting about the debate then, and what continues to be interesting about the debate in the wake of the attacks in Boston, is that there's been a lot of outcry to just designate people as enemy combatants without any frame of reference about what you have to, who is the enemy, and what you have to do to qualify to be an enemy combatant. There seems to be some rash claim, I think, that if one engages in terrorism and it seems to be jihadist terrorism, you can simply designate that person as an enemy combatant. And the reason that that would be helpful, of course, is that you can then detain the person without trial and without counsel and without Miranda warnings and prioritize the interrogation and the gathering of intelligence in order to try to prevent any future attacks. I think there has to be obviously legal authority to do that that is tied to the authorization of military force, which is what makes somebody an enemy. And while I am I'm very sympathetic to the post 9/11 approach, I mean, if you have to make a decision and you have only two choices, and the choices are is it a crime or is it a war, I think it's a lot closer to a traditional war than a crime wave. And I think the wages of terrorism are obviously so profound that we need to have a way to detain people, even if they can't be tried in the criminal justice system for a variety of reasons. But there has to be a legal infrastructure in place to do that. And what we've seen in the Boston attack is the real problems and pitfalls of the lack of such an infrastructure. So you have a situation where these bombings take place. There is one surviving bomber that we know of. It's unclear whether he has any relation to the enemy Congress has identified for the use of force. There are a number of people, myself included, who would like to have seen him detained designated at least temporarily as an enemy combatant, so that agents could interrogate him outside the criminal justice system to obtain information about whether there were any attacks that were imminent and planned, and to obtain information about what, if any, network that they may have had that may have been threatening to the United States. But the big problem with all of that was that it's not clear, at least on our current state of information, whether there is such a tie that would render this character an enemy combatant. If there's not, there's a huge question about whether there is a legal basis to hold somebody who is not an enemy combatant outside the criminal justice system so that you can do an interrogation. There's been a lot of hue and cry about the fact that Miranda warnings were given by a magistrate judge to the guy who's in custody, whose name is Zhokhar Tsarnaev. I think that the criticism of the magistrate judge is misplaced. The fact that the magistrate judge appeared with defense counsel and with a prosecutor to do a presentment hearing became inevitable when less than 48 hours after capturing Zhokhar Tsarnaev, the Justice Department chose to file a criminal complaint in federal court in Boston. Once that happened, it was inevitable that there would be a presentment hearing under the federal rules of criminal procedure. And in fact, because the guy was in the custody of the of the executive branch, there's no way that the court, that the judge, the defense lawyer, and the kit and caboodle that came from the courthouse to the hospital to do the presentment hearing, there's no way they could have gotten there without that being coordinated with the Justice Department and the FBI. So I think the decision was made very early on to file a criminal complaint. I believe it was a politically driven decision to end any discussion about whether Tsarnaev was an enemy combatant or a criminal defendant. The idea was, let's just make him a criminal defendant. That'll end that debate, and then we move on to the next stages of the criminal proceeding. But I do think that it's incumbent on people like myself, who argue that the case could have been handled in a different way, to grapple with the fact that it's not entirely clear at this point, that Tsarnaev has any connections to groups that would be that would fit into the category of groups that Congress has authorized the use of military force against. So that's a big problem. And secondly, I have argued that there was enough there, particularly the likelihood that the older brother was trained in Dagestan, where there are Al-Qaeda affiliates, that there was enough there suggesting that there could be a connection to the enemy that we're fighting, that you could temporarily designate Zhokhar Tsarnaev as an enemy combatant, while the agents ran down the question whether he was an enemy combatant or not, whether you could really firm up those ties. And in the meantime, you could have kept his interrogation going. The last point I'll make before I turn back to Dean Reuter for questions is that a lot of the it seems to me that there's a big difference between the great issues that are being debated in the public discussion. That is, this whole idea of philosophically, do we treat modern terrorism as a war or a crime? Should he have been an enemy combatant? Should he have been a criminal defendant? Should he have gotten Miranda warnings and the like? That's the public debate, and it's perfectly appropriate. But having worked on these cases, I think the thing that often gets lost is prosecutors and investigators are typically less interested in the great issues that that drive the public debate than they are about the practical issues of building a case and doing it in a way that is appropriately deferential to the needs of national security. And what I mean concretely in making that distinction is as a prosecutor here, I think, based on everything that I've been able to see in the press about the case, that you would feel like you were playing with the house money, in a sense, as far as interrogation is concerned. That is to say, the case against Dzhokhar Tsarnaev looks, at least, like it, from this vantage point. Of course, it's easy to say from the cheap seats, but at least from what we're seeing in the reporting, it looks like it's an overwhelming case, and that you would not need a confession to try to prove the case against this particular terrorist, either to prove the guilt phase of the case, or even satisfy the jury with respect to the death penalty phase. It certainly does look like we're going in that direction. With that being said, assuming that that's the reality that the prosecutors are seeing, I would have been much less concerned about being fastidious with respect to the rules of criminal procedure, the demands that, when you detain somebody, you're required to bring them promptly to the nearest available magistrate and the like, because the remedy, if you make a mistake on those issues, is that any statement that the guy makes is suppressed at trial. And if you're not worried about statements being suppressed because you don't need the statements, then I think the thing that you have to do as a prosecutor is let the agents do what they have to do to get as much information as they can, because this is an intelligence gathering exercise where you're not looking to firm up the case at trial, and if you, I might even as a prosecutor tell the judge, look, we're not going to use his statements, unless he gets up and testifies and they're admissible for purposes of impeachment. I don't think they'd be necessary for the government's case. And that being the case, I don't know that I would have done great mental acrobatics to try to figure out what basis can we hold this guy under so that we can continue to detain him. I might have just tried to continue to detain him and dared somebody to file a writ of habeas corpus to try to get him out from under that status while the agents did the questioning. So with that, why don't I stop there and turn it back over to Dean.
Thank you so much. We're now going to open the floor to questions from the audience. We've got quite a few people on the line. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for best-selling author Andy McCarthy, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll try and get to as many of the callers as possible. It looks like we start off with three questions, so let's go to our first caller.
Hi, thank you for this really excellent presentation. I have one question that's been intriguing me, which is this guy just became a citizen, this suspect who's being held up in Boston. He just became a citizen. He clearly was planning on doing something like this while he was going through the citizenship and naturalization process. Why can't we just revoke his citizenship?
Dean, can I go ahead and answer?
Yeah, go ahead and answer.
Okay. My understanding, and it's been a while since I've looked at this, but my understanding of the law of revoking citizenship is that you can revoke your citizenship can be revoked if it is procured by fraud, or if someone commits actions which effectively amount to a revocation of the citizenship. But then you have to go in and prove that that what he's done is tantamount to saying, I'm the enemy of America and I break any of my ties of fealty to the United States. That's a legal process that one would have to go through. We did have one case, the Hamdi case back in 2004, where after the Supreme Court upheld the Bush administration's decision to treat Hamdi as an enemy combatant because he had taken up arms against the United States in the fighting that occurred in Afghanistan. He was eventually repatriated to Saudi Arabia, which suggests that they didn't have a great prosecutable war crimes case, I imagine. But one of the conditions of his repatriation to Saudi Arabia was that he agreed to renounce his citizenship so that he's no longer a U.S. citizen. But what was not covered in that agreement was if he had refused to do that, whether the government would have tried to go into court and prove that he had effectively renounced his citizenship, which I think is a high burden. I think that, you know, the bottom line is if you have not procured your citizenship by fraud that can be proved, revocation of citizenship is difficult. It's not impossible, but I think it's a difficult hurdle for the government.
He took an oath to uphold the Constitution at the same time that he was planning an attack that was clearly a terrorist attack.
Right. Well, we don't know that he took an oath at the time he was planning a terrorist attack. In fact, that was one of the things I've been here at Fox talking about today was, you know, what can you make of the timeline that's developing as a result of the arrest of these three students that were associates of Jokar's who seem to have been involved in obstructing the law enforcement investigation after the bombing. And I think if you look at the complaint, indications are that they may not have figured out that he was complicit in the bombing until after the bombing happened, but evidently he did tell them about a month ago that he knew how to build a bomb. My operating theory about this, and just so to the extent this is interesting to anyone, the bright line between success and failure for terrorist attacks over the years has been training. Basically, successful terrorist attacks are committed by terrorists who have undergone training, whether it's, you know, Hezbollah, Al Qaeda, Hamas training, and the like. There's always been a great stress on training in terrorist organizations. You have a lot of people who have had very ambitious plots, but they never came close to carrying them out. Those tend to be people who haven't gotten training. They're ideologically catalyzed. They share the ideology of organizations like Al Qaeda, but they're simply not competent. So my operating theory on this has been that there has been training. Probably the older brother got training. He was in the Dagestan region, we know, for 6 months. We know that that's a hotbed of not only jihadist ideology, but also training camps that are run by organizations that are loosely affiliated with Al Qaeda. I think we're eventually going to learn that he got training. That is the older guy. Tamerlan got training over there and probably trained the brother. We know now that the brother said sometime around, you know, a month to 6 weeks ago that he knew how to build a bomb. But I don't know that that necessarily means that either that he knew or that at the time he took the oath of citizenship that he had any plans at that point in time to carry out attacks against the United States. That's something that still has to be firmed up.
Thank you.
Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll get to your call momentarily. Before we go to the next caller, let me make a programming announcement about our upcoming schedule. On Monday, we have a teleforum conference call scheduled at 12 noon Eastern time on this same number. We'll be talking about the Department of Labor persuader rule. Under a new interpretation of that little-known rule, lawyers might be soon required to report to the government their clients' services provided and legal fees in some labor union negotiations. That's Monday at 12 noon. And then Wednesday at 1 p.m. we'll be discussing information sharing and privacy in the context of cybersecurity. That's Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We'll be talking about whether information sharing can improve security and protect privacy all at the same time. Today, though, we're talking to best-selling author Andy McCarthy. His new book, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, is available at bookstores and on Amazon.com now. We got three callers with questions pending, so let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Margaret Stock from Anchorage, and thank you, Mr. McCarthy, for doing this forum. I think it's a really important topic. Also, thank you for answering that last question. I've handled those cases, so I agree with your analysis that to denaturalize them, they'd have to show some intent prior to the naturalization, but expatriation is completely different. My question, though, had to do with similar cases. We had a case up in Alaska involving a native-born American military veteran and federal employee, Paul Rockwood, who actually grew up in Boston, ironically, and I think you might recall this case. He had an assassination list, and he had also downloaded schematics of cell phones to make bomb detonators, was buying electronics.
Yes, vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, and he had been radicalized by Anwar al-Awlaki at the Virginia
mm-hmm.
Mosque in 2001, and apparently
right.
was hanging out here up in Alaska feeling bad and wanting to attack the United States and wage jihad, along with his wife, who is an American citizen as well, but she held dual citizenship in Britain. He never actually carried out any attacks, but other than that, it has some eerie similarities to the Boston situation, you know, somebody who got radicalized over the internet and was working with a family member, had
right.
had definite plans to carry out attacks, had the capability of doing it, U.S. military veteran, he'd had some training. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on how the government should be handling cases where they, you know, become aware of this. In Rockwood's case, they handled it traditionally. They just handled it as a criminal case, and he's doing 8 years in federal prison. But can you just comment on how we should handle these cases before they actually come to fruition and attack somebody?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think the interesting overhaul of the let me back up for a second. There's been two major pieces of legislation directed to counterterrorism since the 1993 bombings. The Patriot Act is the one that got all of the ink, but I've always thought the much more consequential one was the 1996 was the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which really was a dramatic overhaul of American counterterrorism law. And after the 96 Act, I think you could have a good philosophical debate, and I know we've had one, about whether we're dealing with a war or a crime, whether people should be handled in the military system or the civilian system. But you could never again complain, as we were able to complain in the days of the 93 attack and the plot that followed it to strike New York City landmarks, that the array of statutes that prosecutors had access to at that time to deal with terrorism was inadequate. I remember that when we were trying to figure out what to charge against the people in the Blind Sheikh's cell, who had not been involved in the Trade Center attack, had been involved in the unsuccessful plot to bomb New York City landmarks, it turned out that back then we didn't even have a federal bombing conspiracy statute. So, you know, if you carried out a successful bombing, we had a perfectly adequate penalty for you. You could get life in prison, especially if you killed anyone. But if you only conspired to bomb, even if the conspiracy anticipated killing tens of thousands of people, that had to be brought under the all-purpose federal conspiracy statute, which is a 0 to 5 year penalty, obviously inadequate. So those sorts of problems were dealt with by Congress in the 96 Act, which has very good statutes in it, which really are designed directly to take on the types of terrorism offenses that we've seen. The most important of them, and this goes to your question about interrupting or your point about interrupting attacks ahead of time, the most important of them is the Material Support to Terrorism Act, which is charged in almost every terrorism case post-1996, and the design of which really is to try to interrupt these cells, choke off their funding and their other material support in order to stop attacks from getting momentum and to stop these cells from having the capacity to carry out big terrorist attacks. So it was very much in keeping with what the approach became 9/11, which was to stop these attacks from happening, rather than content yourself with being able to prosecute whoever was available to be prosecuted after Americans had already been killed. The big problem, and I think the central issue that you always have to deal with in this debate over should somebody be handled in the military justice system or should it be in the civilian justice system, is always intelligence. It is simply easier to protect national defense information in the military rules than it is in the civilian courts. That means, to me at least, that presumptively, if someone is not a member of Al-Qaeda or one of Al-Qaeda's affiliates, the array of organizations that Congress has identified as the enemy for purposes of the use of military force, then presumptively those terrorism cases belong in the civilian justice system, unless and until we develop a third system. Because you can't complain in that situation that the prosecution will force you to turn over an intelligence that we have about the enemy during wartime. And the insanity of prosecuting our enemies in civilian court during wartime is that the due process rules and the way that the trial itself plays out gives the enemy who's trying to who is in fact waging war against us, gives them a very education on not only what we know, but how we develop information, what our methods are, what our sources are, and just the substantive information itself. So my bright line here, for want of a better term, is if you're in a situation where you're dealing with an offender and an offense which would prompt you under the rules to have to turn over that kind of intelligence in discovery, then that's a case that belongs in the military system. If it's not, if it's what they call the self-radicalization, I hate that term, by the way, because nobody, you know, this is like another politically correct thing to prevent acknowledging that it's Islamic supremacist ideology that radicalizes people. They don't radicalize themselves. You know, it's self-radicalization and homegrown and all that stuff is yet more political correctness to not grapple with what we're really dealing with here. But I do think that if you have these spontaneously appearing cells that may be inspired by Al-Qaeda but don't have any operational connection to them, those cases belong in civilian court.
All right. Again, if you want to ask a question of our expert, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, then our lines will be open. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Ben Lerner with Center for Security Policy.
Andy,
I think your third option is intriguing, this idea of having something that is neither traditional law enforcement model nor traditional warfighting model. But assuming, just for sake of present purposes, that Congress can't really get its head around that for whatever reason, and the choice remains between traditional law enforcement paradigm and traditional warfighting paradigm, what are your thoughts on how you might rework the authorization for use of military force to better reflect the spectrum of enemy combatants or spectrum of jihadists who are out there right now posing a threat?
Well, for one thing, I would explicitly name all of the organizations that we now know are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and make provision that, you know, they can't get out of it by just like changing their names the next day to something else. So you would want to tinker with it so that you could deal with that. And there's a lot of statutory schemes where you have to do that. But I also think that Congress needs to make some findings about the ideological component here. What unifies this enemy is Islamic supremacist ideology, and that really is the component that brings some coherent tie to all of these attacks. And it has to be easier if we're going to prevent things like Boston from happening again.
It has to be easier not only to regard the enemy as an enemy, but it has to be easier to do national security surveillance on them as well. And if you don't come to grips with the fact that this has an ideological component, and you're always tiptoeing around the Islam issue and the fact that people are concerned that for some reason, if we take note of the fact that the ideology that that ties all of this together is rooted in Islamic scripture and is a mainstream interpretation of Islam, that is supremacist Islam, that somehow that means that we're the United States is at war with Islam, which I think has always been a preposterous fear, mainly stoked by Islamist organizations in the United States that are tied to the Muslim Brotherhood and that have reason for not wanting us to do surveillance and the like. I think we ought to be very clear that we regard Muslims as essentially an ally, not an enemy in this war. American Muslims in particular, I can testify to the fact that without the assistance of patriotic American Muslims and other Muslims as well, we would not have been able to break up terror cells in the 90s. We wouldn't be able to have the kind of intelligence product that we have today. We wouldn't be able to whip evidence into shape so that we could present it as a compelling narrative in court. So I think we need to be very clear that what we're talking about is a particular interpretation of Islam that has shown itself time and time again to be the most atrocious force in the world in terms of mass attacks against civilian targets and also illegitimate attacks against military targets because they're not honorable enemy combatants. They don't comport themselves with the laws and customs of war. But I don't think that we can do this in a sensible way without taking up the ideological component. I'm not insensitive to the First Amendment issues that raises, but you can't have an ideology which is a comprehensive totalitarian ideology that mainly directs itself to political, economic, and other issues that in the West are deemed to be matters in the bailiwick of civil society. And then just because 10% of it happens to be religious tenets, say that the First Amendment ties your hands from dealing with any of it. I think that's you can't protect a country that way.
We have one more caller on the line with a question. After that, our lines will be completely open. If you'd like to ask the next question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Deborah Weiss, and my question is, we keep hearing that the Russian government warned the U.S. about the brothers and the U.S. government dropped the ball. What should the FBI have done but didn't do, and why do you think they didn't? Is evidence of training insufficient for quote-unquote extremist activity that the president said they weren't engaged in? Or that there wasn't any evidence of?
Deborah, I think that this goes back to the to Ben's question and what I said in response to it, which is that the FBI basically takes the position that under its guidelines, it cannot maintain even a national security investigation until ideology crystallizes into action. So that you have a situation where evidently Russian intelligence comes to the FBI and tells them that they believe that Tamerlan Tsarnaev has become a radical Muslim, that he may be a jihadist, that he seems to be steeped in jihadist ideology, and they are fearful that he is coming to the Dagestan, Chechnya, war-torn region to help prosecute the jihad there against the Russians. Armed with that information, the FBI does an investigation. They learn that, yes, in fact, he is a radical Muslim, and they even interview him and evidently confirm it that way as well. And then they end up closing the investigation based on no derogatory information, because even though they confirmed that he was adherent to the ideology. He hadn't done anything to act on it yet, and he didn't seem to have any active plans to act on it.
Well, the training
now,
doesn't count? Like,
well, training, of course, would count if they had evidence of it, but I don't know that at that time. Remember, when the FBI gets notified, Tsarnaev has not gone to the Dagestan, Chechnya, Russia region at that point. We don't know, or at least I don't know, that there's any evidence that he got training. Now, had he gotten training, and had he, by the way, had they had evidence, you know, had they kept up with the Russians and had the Russians told them, oh, yeah, he was trained in a jihadist camp in Dagestan, then he should not have been permitted to re-enter the United States. Because when the Real ID Act was amended in 2005, I remember this because I testified for it. It was Senator Kyle's amendment. It was amended to make excludable from the United States anybody who has had guerrilla training from a terrorist training camp. So if our government knows that somebody who is not an American citizen who's gotten jihadist training overseas, that person is excludable and should have been kept out of the United States. But evidently they didn't have that evidence either before he went to Russia, and then by the time he came back 6 months later, what we now know is that the FBI had closed the investigation because they hadn't found any quote-unquote derogatory information. But I think, yes, if he had gotten terrorist training, whether it was in the United States or someplace else, then I think the FBI wouldn't have had any trouble with the notion that they needed to continue that investigation, probably as a national security investigation under FISA and those protocols rather than a criminal investigation.
I just want to ask, was that always the standard with the FBI unless there's action that they can't investigate further, or is that just under this administration?
No, it's not under this. This goes back a long way, and they've been tinkering with the guidelines for a long time. Sometimes they loosen them, sometimes they tighten them up, but this is really still all it's amazing how long the legacy of this stuff lasts, but this is really still all the fallout of the COINTELPRO investigations of the late 60s and 70s. That was scandalous, as was the revelations that came out around the Watergate time that the CIA was doing domestic spying. And I think, you know, what ends up happening with these scandals typically is that we overcorrect. And when we overcorrect, we tie our hands so that we don't have authority when we really need it. And, you know, I think back then they decided they really didn't need to have authority to investigate anyone who wasn't actively involved in terrorism, certainly foreign elements. There was a whole to-do about whether, you know, what you were permitted to do with U.S. citizens. But they got comfortable in the idea that you could actually draw basically a divider between along the lines of this nexus between ideology and activity, and that you could refrain and tie your hands from investigating until ideology had crossed over onto the activity side of the line. And of course, you know, one of the things that the FBI will always tell you and the Justice Department will tell you is we always have conspiracy, which is to say, you know, when they say it has to be activity, they don't really necessarily mean that you actually have to be setting a bomb. If you look like you're plotting to do something, they can investigate. But they have not, and they reject the idea that because someone is an Islamic supremacist, he's somebody who ought to be raising alarms. That when they hear an argument like that, they say, "Oh my God, that's profiling."
All right, thank you.
You know, and I don't. You know, as far as profiling is concerned, I must say, having been a prosecutor in New York in the 1980s, this is a very new thing to get as hysterical about as we've become over the years. I must tell you that when I was prosecuting mafia cases, if I had filled the defense table with guys named McCarthy, the jury probably would have left my case out of court.
Our switchboard is lighting up again. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Stanley Cook in the Washington, D.C. area, and by implication, you may have answered my question, but I just want to put it on the table. What I call the, or what I, for the purpose of discussion, would call the 9/11 statute, the follow-up to that activity. And now, your immediate past discussion on the FBI guidelines. Do you think both the statute and the guidelines should be amended to reflect what I'd say is reality?
Yes. No, I think I don't see that it's sensible to say that you can't in a threat environment where we're dealing with an ideologically driven threat to the United States, to say that you can't take note of the ideology until it crystallizes into action is tantamount to saying that we are satisfied to let terrorist attacks happen and prosecute them after people have been killed. And I think that's precisely what we decided right after 9/11 was the wrong way to go. And I think there were very good reasons to make that calculation. I agree, and have agreed for a long time that the military paradigm has a lot of downsides, and that it's not any more of a perfect fit than the civilian justice system is a perfect fit. We ought to be, instead of calling each other names in this debate, depending on which side you're on, we ought to instead be putting our heads together and trying to design a system that is tailored to the actual threat that we're facing. Absolutely, I don't think that you can divorce ideology from the threat when the threat is ideological.
So you would amend the statute, set up this middle ground institution.
Which statute are you talking about?
The statutes that you referred to after the 9/11. You said that certain things, I guess this defined enemy combatant by virtue
of... Well, yeah, I think, right. What I mean by that is that Congress passes the authorization of military for the use of military force about 6 or 7 days after the 9/11 attacks. It hasn't been, it defined the enemy as it was known 6 or 7 days after the 9/11 attacks, but I think 12 years later, we have a better understanding of who the enemy is, and we ought to, overhaul it. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
What do you think, that this is Dean Reuter breaking in, what do you think the likelihood of Congress revisiting the AUMF is?
Dean, I think until something else happens, it will that shows that this is a huge problem, there's not going to be any movement to revisit it, because we just happen to be in a very ideologically divided period where it becomes very difficult for people in Congress to do anything that would at an absolute bare minimum has to be done. And in fact, when you're talking about budgets and stuff like that, they don't even do those. So I think it's very hard right now to move anything through just on the basis that it's a good idea and people might you might get some bipartisan agreement on it.
Let's hear from another caller now.
Hello. Hello?
Hi.
You're on. We can hear you.
Oh, thank you very much. I have two quick questions, and the first one stems from what you've been mentioning about this sort of third way, the national security courts. And the question concerns with the increasing tendency of this administration, it seems, to appear to want to lump other religious groups, deny the Islamic ideology behind these acts, but with the Southern Poverty Law Center, the papers that were submitted up at West Point, that white Christian constitutional veterans, changing the nature of who they may ideologically see as a terrorist threat. How do you see that playing out, not too well for your maybe majority American citizen? And the second question has to do with more of, in your viewing, the way in which the entire city was locked down and those things, because I have neighbors that ask me questions, why such a show of force? Why such a door-to-door search? Any comment on that aspect of it? And those are the two questions.
Yeah, on the first issue, I think that's much more of a political than a legal thing, but I'm as offended by it as anyone is. In fact, I got interviewed a day or two after the bombing in Boston when there was speculation about, you know, who might have done it, and it seemed to me that you know, there was an obvious set of suspects out there based on a, you know, serial attacks of the United States, but on the United States that have occurred over the last 20 years, and that possibility seemed to be being discounted for all these other extravagant theories. And I think it was on Lou Dobbs or something that I finally sort of exasperated said, you know, I kind of feel like I ought to confess on behalf of Catholics and right wing nuts everywhere. Because that would seem to be the thing that that a lot of the commentary was hoping for, but I do think that that's a much more right now it's a much more political than a legal issue, and it's again, you know, the administration is trying to bend over backwards to show the Islamic world, which is what they the term that they use, that we don't have it in for Muslims, and you know, we can be just as aggressive against other groups as we are against Muslims. I don't, you know, I think it's an unfortunate way to do business, but I don't think there's much legally that that there is to be done about that at the moment. Your second question again? I'm sorry.
It was just your observation of the way.
The lockdown. Yeah, you know, look, I think there was clearly overkill, and, you know, effectively it seemed that for about 24 hours or so, Boston seemed to be over. I don't want to be too critical of that because I've been through this sort of thing, and I know why it happens. And you know, when you have this massive paramilitary capability, which law enforcement both on the federal and the state levels has these days, it's in a circumstance like this that you're apt to see it. And I understand why it would be frightening and disturbing to people. On the other hand, after the 9/11 attacks, I remember that we did things like scoop people up on material witness warrants because we didn't have enough evidence to charge them with a crime, and we didn't have a military paradigm at all that we were talking about. Nobody even thought about enemy combatants in those weeks right after the 9/11 attacks. So you had to have a way to take people into custody who might have been dangerous to the public, but we didn't have enough evidence to prove it under circumstances where we were under attack. 3,000 at the time, there were estimates that it may have been tens of thousands of people had been killed in the Trade Center attacks. And everybody thought, and when I say everybody, I mean everybody who was in the command post and in these whirlwind teleconferences we had in the days after the attacks, everybody thought there would be a second wave of attacks and was trying to identify who would be involved in them. And a lot of things that were that, you know, seemed in hindsight to have been excessive at the time actually seemed like the only right thing to do. So, you know, is this something to be concerned about? Is it something to be very alarmed about? I think so. You know, if you're a Second Amendment activist, you know, you were told in Massachusetts, which has very, very strict gun control laws, to stay in your house and not open the door. In the meantime, if the terrorists had come in, nobody would have been armed except for the terrorists. So, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be drawn, but I don't want to be overly critical of the way that the law enforcement people handled the dragnet because, you know, again, they were operating under circumstances where there was reason to believe more bombs had been strewn around Boston. And then the shootouts, as I understand it, with the police, they were not just exchanging fire. There was explosives also, if not launched, at least tossed at the police or planted or what have you by the terrorists. It was a very, very dangerous situation.
under circumstances where they had just been on the receiving end of a horrific attack, and I'm not going to criticize the way they handled it.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Andy McCarthy. We have been talking to Andy about the events in Boston. He's the best-selling author of the new book, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. We're out of time. We certainly appreciate you breaking from your busy schedule to give us all the information you have. We certainly appreciate that. I want to invite our audience to join us for our next Teleform conference call on Monday at noon, when we'll be talking about the Department of Labor persuader rule. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.